loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about the Manafort trial. Rick Gates, the big fish, testified yesterday and again today, and we found out that he stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from Paul Manafort himself. Today, he continued testifying, adding more information about the millions that Manafort received from wealthy Ukrainians. And then we continue our Tuesday weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, private emails obtained by the publication Foreign Policy show that White House advisor and presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner last year tried to abolish the United Nations aid agency that provides humanitarian relief to millions of Palestinian refugees. The magazine adds that Kushner was acting at the behest of the Israeli government. Next, the Trump administration will soon release a proposal limiting full citizenship pathways for legal immigrants who have used life-saving health and poverty programs like Obamacare, according to four different sources. Many of these programs have been designed with immigrants in mind. Then, 66 people were shot this weekend in Chicago, with 12 killed. But when the police held a press conference yesterday, the primary message was that people in the neighborhoods where the victims were shot needed to be held accountable rather than the police. Mayor Rahm Emanuel said, quote, "Don't think for a moment people don't know in the neighborhood who is responsible," unquote. And then a new report from Forbes reveals a pattern of highly questionable business practices on the part of Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, resulting in fines, judgments, and settlements totaling over $120 million. Is this kind of scandal inevitable in government? Especially in a government of, by, and for the billionaires. And finally, one of Syria's top rocket scientists was assassinated in a car bomb attack in Damascus on Saturday. Fingers pointed almost immediately to Israel's intelligence agency, the Mossad. Mossad has long had a policy of killing scientists from other countries, actions that are taken with impunity. And in other headlines, as the U.S. reimposed sanctions on Iran this week after pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, President Trump tweeted that any company doing business with Iran will no longer be permitted to do business with the United States. This comes after Iran rejected talks with the U.S. after Trump pulled out of the deal, which was officially known as the JCPOA. It's election day in many states, with races in Ohio, Kansas, Michigan, Missouri, and Washington. President Trump has weighed in on a special election in Ohio for Congress, endorsing the Republican candidate Troy Balderson. Voters in Missouri will vote on whether to become a right-to-work state, sometimes called a right-to-work-for-less state. After months of intense scrutiny, former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak will be charged tomorrow with money laundering in a multi-billion-dollar scandal where he allegedly transferred the equivalent of over $10 million into his personal bank account from state funds. The investigation began when Mahathir Mohamad was elected prime minister in May. Former lawyer for President Trump, Michael Cohen, is being investigated for tax fraud, according to documents obtained by the Wall Street Journal. Federal prosecutors in New York are looking into hundreds of thousands of dollars of income from a taxi medallion business over several years, as well as loans that Cohen may have received without providing adequate documentation. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the trial of Paul Manafort. There were bombshell revelations in the trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort yesterday, as his former deputy and friend Rick Gates testified against him. Gates not only said that he and Manafort had hidden millions of dollars offshore to avoid paying taxes, but he also admitted to stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars from Manafort's accounts in Cyprus. Gates faces Manafort's attorneys in cross-examination today, where he has talked all about wealthy Ukrainians paying Manafort large sums of money. We're joined from New York City by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. And we're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Raleigh. Colleen is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. Colleen and Ted, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Colleen, let's start with you. obviously it's a dramatic trial that's taking place. The prosecutors pledged to the judge that they wouldn't talk about Russia. Matter of fact, I think they had guaranteed that the word Russia wouldn't be mentioned or something like that. Nonetheless, of course, this is in many ways, I don't know, the marquee event so far for the Mueller probe. As you've watched the trial unfold in the last couple of days, and as it came out that the star witness for Mueller is Rick Gates, Manafort's associate, who admitted that he not only has lied and that he not only was engaged in criminal conduct, but he was, as Manafort's partner, also stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars from Manafort. Is it possible that even though there's such a, I would say, highly charged atmosphere around the trial, that some of this will hurt the prosecution?
Well, it's hard. It's really hard to predict. Obviously, Mueller is the quintessential expert prosecutor who knows that in prosecuting conspiracies where there are no good guys, they are all have dirty hands. If you think back to that old Sammy the Bull Gravano, a multi-murderer testifying against John Gotti, that's a great example. But that's really the norm in these kinds of cases. And Mueller knows that he needs to get the information out himself. It's a tactic for the prosecutor to get whatever bad thing is out there that he knows the defense will bring up. He gets it out because that plants in the jury's mind that it's not so bad. So again, we have Mueller, this real expert prosecutor. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with the truth and the facts and the justice of this issue. That just means that we really have an expert prosecutor. And unfortunately, you're right. The nightly news they sometimes just mention that the Manafort case, case is about facts that occurred long before the Trump campaign and long before the Russiagate, et cetera. They mention that, but then they go on to double talk and make it seem as if it is all connected to Russiagate. So I think the bigger issue for us is not really Manafort's money laundering, which is ubiquitous amongst really powerful people in Washington, D.C., and amongst the people like, these financiers and these Wall Street and Enron and WorldCom, et cetera, et cetera. That kind of financial fraud is really a massive problem right now, and a lot of people are engaging in it. But we don't have a Mueller expert prosecutor assigned to delve into it, which from my standpoint, I wish in a way we could clone Mueller 100,000 times and have him really try to go after all this fraud, because it is massive. Manafort is really a small figure in all of the massiveness. And it's unfortunate. I think it's extremely unfortunate that they are connecting it to war and foreign policy. And I think that's, for me, the worst part of this whole thing.
That's Colleen Rulli, FBI whistleblower, named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. We're also talking with Ted Rall, editorial cartoonist, award-winning cartoonist. Ted, two important points. Well, Colleen made multiple important points, but two of them are interconnected. One, fraud, evasion of taxes, wrongdoing, criminal conduct, ubiquitous amongst the political class and amongst the well-to-do, the affluent, the movers and shakers, company heads, and at the same time in the public mind linked to the issue of Russia collusion, because that's what the Mueller probe was supposed to be about. But in fact, this is not about Russia collusion at all. So one, why? And two, if Mueller, even being an excellent prosecutor, as Colleen said, failed to convict Manafort, how big of a deal would that be for the overall standing or credibility of the Mueller probe? In other words, are the stakes high here for Mueller?
I think the stakes are high here for Mueller, and maybe in some ways higher than they are for Manafort, because Manafort seems to be counting on the idea that he might be able to get a presidential pardon in the event that he's convicted, and that he has, I think, considerable reason to believe that that might happen. So he's probably not all that worried. I think Colleen's right. I think Mueller knows exactly what he's doing here. He's getting out in front of this narrative like, look, my guy's a scumbag, but we're here to convict a bigger scumbag. Everyone on the jury has seen police procedurals where lesser criminals are flipped in order to get at bigger ones. So this is a process everyone is familiar with. And I think that he probably, you know, even though the defense will obviously make a lot of hay out of this, look, you're asking us, you know, can you convict someone beyond a reasonable doubt if there's reasonable doubt about their veracity? I mean, after all, can you really trust a guy who admits that he lied to his own boss and stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from him, and not to mention willingly participated in large-scale tax fraud and money laundering? So these are all, you know, I think it's possible, certainly, for Manafort's attorneys to get an acquittal, but I wouldn't bet on it, and it doesn't look good for Manafort. In terms of the why, I think, you know, there's a bigger issue here. I mean, $18,000 ostrich jackets aside, I found myself feeling sorry in a way for Manafort, because I thought, here's a guy who's been kind of caught in the crosshairs of an investigation that kind of shouldn't happen. If you really think about legal procedure, it's not really cool to have law enforcement going in, purportedly investigating one matter, in this case, alleged Russian collusion with the Trump administration in the 2016 presidential campaign. And then they come in and they serve search warrants and rifle all through your stuff. And then they find, hey, you didn't pay taxes back in 2005. And then they go after that. It's just, you know, it's kind of like, it feels like cheating. And it feels like the kind of power, it feels like the kind of law enforcement overreach that could be used in an abusive way. You know, I definitely could make a slippery slope argument here.
I want to ask Colleen about juries. Colleen, you've testified lots of times in federal court. The cliche in the Eastern District of Virginia, where this trial is taking place, is that a jury there would convict a bologna sandwich if asked to do so. Do you think that's true, or does Paul Manafort have a real shot here at being acquitted? And do you think jurors would believe that the prosecution had overreached on some of these charges?
Well, it only takes one juror to not be swayed by some of this. And if that juror is strong enough, they can get a hung jury. They have to hold out, of course, if the other ones are all arguing with them. But the problem with juries, and they are probably the best thing, there's a funny phrase about that, because it's the only system we have, and they do work in many cases. However, the jury system is far from being perfect. It's got all kinds of flaws. And you see all the emphasis now by attorneys in picking the jury. They hire psychologists to look at body language. I mean, I think there's even a TV show about that. How to pick juries so that they are on your side. The venue selection, the questions that they ask in voir dire, all of these things are really a large segment of the grounds for appeal right now. The facts of the case and what goes on in the trial are really almost minimal compared to what goes into jury selection. Unfortunately, that's, again, it's kind of a bad thing, because it doesn't mean that the factual justice here. It means that you are playing the game. Attorneys know how to play this game with picking of juries, and certainly the venue is very important. But in the Manafort case, I doubt that any venue in the United States would be a whole lot better, just because it has received such national publicity. And like Ted just said, the stakes are so high right now for Mueller, and most people are seeing this as a political cause as opposed to the facts of the case itself mattering.
That's Colleen Raleigh. We're talking to Colleen, former FBI officer whistleblower named in 2002 Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we're also talking with award-winning editorial cartoonist Ted Rall about the trial, the second day of trial, or the second day of Rick Gates' testimony at the trial of Paul Manafort. I want to go back to the sort of the way this gets linked to Russia, even though it's actually not connected to Russia. There are some other points of information here that I don't think the audience understands. I think very few people actually understand. And that is, what was Paul Manafort actually doing in Ukraine? Because Yanukovych, the government that he was working for, the president he was working for, which was a government led by the Party of Regions, which was mainly representing Russian-speaking Ukrainians, that the eastern part of Ukraine. People kind of think in the popular mind, Russia probe, Russia collusion, Putin, Trump, Ukraine, Ukrainian oligarchs, Manafort there. He must be kind of working for the Russians because he's helping Yanukovych, who is described as a pro-Russian Ukrainian president, now deposed. That's not true. Manafort did work for Yanukovych, but the Russians at that time, and this is back before the 2016 campaign, perceived Manafort to be a threat because he was trying to move Yanukovych in the direction of an alliance with the European Union and the Western countries. He was trying, for instance, to get Yanukovych to take Ukrainian language courses because Yanukovych mainly was a Russian speaker. He wanted to have a closer relationship with the Western part of Ukraine. You know, Manafort and Gates at that time were lobbying and trying to get Yanukovych to come into what ultimately led to an EU ultimatum in the fall of 2013, demanding that Yanukovych make up his mind with Russia or with the EU. And when Yanukovych balked and insisted on a better deal with the EU, that's when the Maidan protests started that ultimately led to his ouster. But Ted Rall, that's lost in this whole thing. Manafort was actually trying to lobby Yanukovych to move into the Western camp. I don't think people know that.
No, and I think it's pretty much hopeless, even if they listen to us, that's going to stay in the American popular imagination. I mean, unfortunately, most Americans can barely keep track of their own political system and how it works and their own constitution. They just don't have, I say this really with sadness, and as someone who reports a lot on foreign countries, including the former Soviet Union, I wish there were greater interest, but there just isn't. People don't have, in the U.S., very few people have any sense, for example, that Ukraine is a former Soviet republic and that all former Soviet republics have significant populations of ethnic Russians who were left there at the end of the Soviet collapse in 1991, and that there has been political schisms in the electoral systems of the countries there that have democracies, or that, for example, Yanukovych, who is always characterized in the U.S. media as pro-Russian or pro- or Putin-aligned, was democratically elected and was overthrown in a coup that contained fascist elements and was almost certainly supported to some extent by the CIA. This is just too much. It's too granular. It's hard for people to follow. It's like Iran-Contra. People still don't understand what happened there, and that was 30 years ago.
Yeah, Colleen, you know, this is part of what, again, I think Ted's right. People aren't going to know it, and even if we say it here, it's not going to really register with that many people. But this is actually from Gates' testimony, John, at the trial. He said that Manafort had crafted a policy for Yanukovych aimed at bringing Ukraine into the European Union called Engage Ukraine, and that Manafort recruited not only Americans, and I think maybe Tony Podesta's name will eventually rise in this, but Manafort recruited top former European politicians to help out with that effort. That's what Gates is saying as a prosecution witness, that Manafort was trying to recruit Europeans and others to bring Yanukovych into the Engage Ukraine, meaning with the EU. And Colleen Raleigh, it's very interesting. Manafort had house arrest, but then was put back into jail because they said he was trying to tamper with witnesses possibly in Ukraine. He was sending through third-party people, liaisons, a reminder to them, don't forget if you get interviewed that we were actually trying to move Ukraine away from Russia and into the United States. That was actually what the judge said was a kind of jury or witness tampering. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, that kind of surprises me that would rise up to be considered jury tampering. It obviously, the things I'm aware with in working organized crime were a lot more explicit than that. They were, you know, veiled threats to kill you, et cetera. And that's jury tampering. I'm very familiar with that version. This sounds like really all he was trying to do was remind people to tell the truth about the situation. And that's a truth that actually now has come out in trial. And just because our media, you know, I didn't know this because I didn't hear it on our nightly news. Our news is obviously ignoring that portion of the testimony because it doesn't fit their preconceived notions of things. So it's difficult, as Ted said, to try to educate people at this late stage. And now with all the social media, you know, clamping down on suspending accounts and shadow banning and all these things, that it's even more, I think it's even more difficult to get the truth out about things. But at least there is this trial, so there is a chance, and maybe there will be more people that will pick up on this. This is an important piece of information that should, and it definitely goes against the whole Russiagate narrative right now. So we'll do our best to try to get that info out.
Colleen, a follow-up. Tell me a little bit about why a prosecutor would be allowed to introduce as evidence lifestyle issues like this ostrich jacket or a $50,000 watch. Is it just to sort of poison the jury and to make them dislike the defendant? Or is there some other legal reason why evidence like that would be admitted, or why the prosecution would seek to have evidence like that admitted?
The kind of cases this kind of thing comes out in, the ones that really spring to my mind are money laundering cases, where they really want to show that the person was living beyond their means. And you're right, they're using it also at what we used to call sex appeal. You use it in order to kind of prejudice the jury, too, because you say, oh, anybody who parades around in ostrich feathers must have something wrong with them, etc. So he's got a dual purpose here. But it does come out in money laundering cases about how the money was laundered, and then finally spent. And so Mueller can say that he's justified in getting that information out.
I'd like to just talk about the instrument of conspiracy, because conspiracy doesn't mean that a crime had to be committed. It just means that two or more people had to agree to commit a crime. And even if no crime is committed, the fact that they entered into this agreement with each other is a conspiracy. That gives prosecutors a tremendous power, doesn't it, Colleen? Let's just stay with you real quick, and then we'll go back to Ted, because you are and were with the FBI.
Yes, it does. And I'm going to go back to your earlier point about how if you get a chance to search and scrutinize someone, it's very similar to what police call pretext stops. If they follow any driver for any length of time, they will notice that they did a rolling stop or their blinker was dim, and any number of things that they then can say, there's a reason, there's a justification for stopping this person. It's very similar to what you were explaining at the start, that if you are looking at somebody and scrutinizing them and searching their house and et cetera, it's quite unlikely that you won't, especially with these movers and shakers, that you won't be able to opportunistically find something that you can charge.
Ted Rall, you know, here's the thing, is that Manafort has already, in a way, been convicted. He's been convicted in the court of public opinion. Manafort tried to get the trial moved, and Colleen said at the beginning, venue is extremely, extremely important.
And he's got the two worst courts in America, in D.C. and the Eastern District of Virginia.
And you can't make the argument at all that in Washington, D.C. or suburban Maryland or Northern Virginia, you have a lot of friends of Donald Trump. And of course, Manafort was Donald Trump's campaign chairperson for a little while. But again, do the facts matter enough to make a difference? Manafort ran out of money, basically, when Yanukovych was overthrown by a U.S.-led coup d'etat. U.S.-supported coup d'etat. EU supported it, too. He ran out of money, and then Gates is saying, look, we were getting income, some income, but we didn't want to pay taxes on it, so we pretended that they were loans. And thus, if a loan is a loan, then you pay it back. You don't have to tax it as income. It's that kind of thing that Mueller's got Manafort over the barrel with, apparently, seemingly. So here's the question. Can people in the jury step away even from the factual presentation of the prosecutors and say, look, you know, bottom line, big picture, this trial wouldn't be happening except for politics. And as a consequence, I'm just not going to go along. I mean, can we envision that kind of a thing happening with a jury pool in spite of this very rarefied political atmosphere in which the trial takes place?
You know, sometimes all nine planets line up in a row, so weird things happen, but it's not likely. We're talking about a system that doesn't really, that tries to screen out jurors who might be prone toward jury nullification, which is what you're really talking about. And I don't think it's likely. Now, I think if I was defense counsel here, and I'm not an attorney, but I've spent more than my fair share in courtrooms over the years, I would probably try to make Manafort as relatable as possible, $50,000 watches aside, and try to say, look, this guy's rich, but hey, lots of people are rich, and being rich isn't a crime. The part that I just can't fathom is how his defense attorneys are going to really make a credible case against the fundamental charges of money laundering and tax evasion. I mean, look, I didn't have time to file taxes, or people that the Ukrainians didn't want me to. Is just, those aren't defenses. Those are like a child's excuses. So obviously the defense hasn't made their case yet, so that's going to be interesting. But so far it's looking really devastating for Manafort, and I would bet on a conviction. But I will say that if he pulls a rabbit out of the hat here, the big winner is Donald Trump, because people, as we discussed earlier, are just, you know, they're working long hours, they're following the headlines, the breaking news alerts on their smartphones, and if Manafort is acquitted, that people are going to take away from this, look, that was the first step in the Russiagate probe. Mueller failed. This Russia thing, there's nothing there. And I think even a sizable number of Democrats who believe that there's a Russian collusion reality are going to start to have serious doubts.
So we have about a minute and a half left. I want to point out also that this is just phase one in Paul Manafort's legal troubles. He's being tried on these 18 felony charges in the Eastern District of Virginia. When this trial is over, whether he's acquitted or convicted, he goes on trial again in Washington, D.C., in the Federal District of the District of Columbia on additional felony charges. Colleen, assuming that he's convicted in Virginia, and the likelihood, of course, is very high that he will be convicted because almost everybody's convicted. He's 69 years old. Even if these sentences run concurrently, are we talking about Paul Manafort dying in prison?
Well, as Ted pointed out, his biggest or his best hope is a presidential pardon. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot will depend on the politics there, depending on the timing and everything else. But many politicians who have been convicted of serious felonies have eventually been pardoned.
Yeah, that That's happens. True. What about 10 seconds left? What about Rick Gates? Does he go to jail?
I think he will. But just to make it look like, make it look good, I think maybe he will get some small amount of jail time. It's possible he'll only get probation if he testifies, but I would think maybe they have to make it look like he's being punished to some extent, especially if Manafort gets life in prison.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Minnesota by Colleen Raleigh. Colleen is a former FBI special agent, and in 2002, she was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we've been joined from New York by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series every Tuesday called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst in San Francisco, or in the San Francisco Bay Area. Daniel Sankey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, as you do every week before this show, you submit some of the big stories. And I want to get to your stories, but I want to raise another story that you, I don't know, we didn't talk about it ahead of time, but I'm sure you can address it. I saw a statistic the other day, and this is during a time when the stock market is clearly booming, it's hit record levels, that the number of Americans living in their vehicles has increased, has spiked by 46% over last year. And I'm just guessing a lot of those people are actually where you are in California. I mean, what a contrast.
It's pretty dramatic. I mean, if you think about the record highs that the stock market hit this year on multiple occasions, and then you contrast it with the poverty here. I mean, San Francisco is really a microcosm of that, where you have tech companies that are worth hundreds of millions, sometimes billions of dollars, that are building monuments to themselves. Salesforce built this massive tower, the largest tower in San Francisco. And then the poverty that you see everywhere, everywhere you go, there are people living in tents, there are people living under bridges, there are people, you know, addicted to drugs, desperate, just trying to survive. It's really kind of a gilded age, you know, this sort of veneer of prosperity and wealth that covers the very real poverty of places like the Bay Area, which is numbered in the thousands of homeless people, people who can barely scrape by, barely survive. The gentrification, the housing prices, and this explosion of wealth, it's really indicative of our system that when there is an opportunity for wealth to increase dramatically, there is always at the other end an immiseration of a group of people. That for wealth, the likes of which we see in the tech industry or the stock markets, to accumulate that way, others must go severely without. And that's really what we're seeing here.
Yeah, and a lot of the people living in their cars now are working people.
Oh yeah, working and making money that would actually allow them a decent life in other parts of the country.
Yeah. In other words, if you're in San Francisco, if you're in Portland, I was looking at the cities where there's off the charts pricing for rents and mortgages. Anyway, it's largely about housing.
It's all about housing. And I think it's really important what John mentioned is these are working people. These aren't people that are necessarily, you know, completely unable to work. They actually have jobs, and the jobs pay such a pitiful amount that they have to live in their cars. Now, maybe you could say, well, they could go somewhere else to make a living in, you know, a less expensive region of the United States. But the truth is those areas don't have jobs. And those areas have even far less paying jobs as well. And there's subsequent poverty. So people, you know, flock to the Bay Area in droves, sometimes driving 2-3 hour long commutes, because this is where the work is. This is where the jobs are. So you got to chase those jobs. And there isn't an opportunity for them in a lower priced area for them to actually have a decent job. So what you get is this, you know, insanity of people working multiple jobs and living in their automobiles. I think, you know, the statistic is something that we might expect to see in, you know, some other so-called third world country where people are, you know, forced to live under a dictatorship or something like that, some sort of caricature that we're used to. But this is the United States. People are living in their cars, that this is becoming a lifestyle for many, many working people. And it's incredibly brutal.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Every Tuesday, we talk to Daniel in this segment called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel, Apple's market cap hits $1 trillion. That's a big record, not just for Apple, but for any corporation.
Yes, and I think I wanted to raise this especially because this is currently the history's most valuable company. This has never happened before, and this is the first time it's happened. And, you know, this comes on our conversation about housing and people living in cars. $1 trillion is an astronomical amount of money. It's really kind of inconceivable. It's just sort of a one with a seemingly endless row of zeros after it. But this amount of wealth could be transformative to society in a beneficial way. $1 trillion would fund this gaping deficit that we're starting to have thanks to the GOP tax plan. $1 trillion could remake our whole housing infrastructure to provide affordable housing. $1 trillion could do so many things to socially benefit society. And instead, what it's done is it's being controlled by a very small group of people, Tim Cook, you know, the head CEO, and his investors and board members, people who are a tiny percentage of our population, instead control this $1 trillion market. I think it's important. This shows the insanity of society. Those people will never spend $1 trillion. They'll never need $1 trillion. There's no way they could even go through it. I think they would be hard pressed to try to somehow burn through $1 trillion. And yet we have other people living in cars for whom $5,000 would be transformative. You know, that could completely give them an opportunity to restart their life, maybe make a, you know, down payment on a rental or something like that. And yet instead it's aggregated under these people. This is a natural kind of march of monopoly capitalism. These corporations will become larger and larger and larger as they gobble up more of the market and become these massive behemoths with wealth concentrated into a significantly tinier hands of people. And that's what we're seeing with Apple's recent $1 trillion valuation.
We should add, too, that Apple is sort of famous in this space for hoarding cash. So it's not that it's worth $1 billion just because it sells, you know, $1 trillion rather, because it sells 10 billion iPhones. It also has billions upon billions of dollars in cash that it parks offshore, places like Ireland, for example, or Luxembourg. It came up during the Panama Papers scandal, for example. Daniel's absolutely right. That money could be put to such great use, even in terms of research and development, where you can hire thousands of people and put them to work instead of just leaving it in these offshore accounts and not paying even any taxes on it.
What's the difference between a million and a billion and a trillion?
Uh-huh.
Let's talk about that. I mean, let's just take a moment. What's a popular way to understand it, Daniel?
Well, a billion is 1,000 millions, right?
We're going to have fun with this one, John.
So 1,000 millions, and then a trillion is 1,000 billions.
Yeah.
$1 million is more than any of us will probably ever see in our lifetimes.
That's right.
We won't see a fraction of that. And a million is a tiny fraction of $1 trillion. It's actually a very small amount compared to a trillion. That's how absurd this is. So we can make 1,000 billionaires with that $1 trillion.
If you put a dollar down every second of every day, every second it goes by, you put a dollar down, in 12 days you will have put down $1 million. To get to a billion, you would have to put a dollar down every second for 31 years. And to get to a trillion, you'd have to put a dollar down every second for the next 31,688 years.
Exactly.
Boy, that puts things into perspective.
It is literally more money than you could count. Yeah, it's literally more money than a human being could count in their lifetime, right? If you started counting when you, the moment you were born, roughly a dollar a second, you would die before you were done counting. You know, that is the incredible social wealth. And we're told that, you know, Apple deserves it. Apple earned it. But the truth is, Apple didn't create this wealth. Tim Cook didn't create this wealth. Many, many workers all over the world created this wealth.
A lot of them are in China.
Many of them are in China, absolutely, at these factories where they are super exploited. There's also workers in the U.S. that are exploited as well. And many workers came together to assemble these phones, to sell them, to design them, to produce them. And these workers get, you know, pennies, get virtually nothing, which is, of course, why Apple is worth $1 trillion now. Because if those workers were getting wages commensurate with the tremendous wealth they're creating and the wealth through this creation of this hardware, this amazing software, then there's no way Apple would be worth $1 trillion. They'd have to actually give the people, you know, what they created, what they deserved. But, you know, in the current way we organize our society, they get to own that. They get to control that. And that is why they're worth $1 trillion, because people in places like China work for pennies, work 12, 16-hour days, 6 days a week, and, you know, kind of get their life burned away through these factories so that people like Tim Cook can own $1 trillion company.
I want to do more of the arithmetic.
All right.
If you spend $1,000 a day, I think I'm right on this. If you spend $1,000 a day, every day, in 3 years, you will have spent $1 million. If you want to get to $1 billion, if you spend $1,000 a day, it's not 3 years. It's not 30 years. It's not 300 years. If you spend $1,000 a day since the birth of Christ, you would still not be to a billion. That's the difference, where you get to a million after 3 years of spending $1,000 a day. So when we talk about these kind of numbers, and people really don't grasp it, I mean, a trillion, a billion, a million is sort of graspable. And then you have a particular company, one company that has a valuation of $1 trillion. And let's just break it down, because again, the company seems like a company. It's like Apple stores or Apple phones or Apple computers. But the company is really about a social relationship. There are owners of Apple stock, and some of them own a lot of it, and they're the owners. It's their money. It's not because they did the work. They didn't build the iPhones, but they own the thing. And so the $1 trillion, well, it goes to various places, to new equipment, new machinery, wages, et cetera, but a lot of it just stays with the owners.
Yeah, I think when we talk about the company, that's kind of an abstraction. The company doesn't own $1 trillion. A very small group of people own $1 trillion. Tim Cook is one of them. I'm sure if we did a little research, we could find other board members and major investors of Apple. They own all this. So it's a small group of people that own them, not the company. The workers don't get to decide what happens to the $1 trillion, where it's used and how it's used. They're kind of at the whims of it. And that, you know, aggregation of wealth and power is in itself a form. It's kind of a form of social insanity, where people are desperate for just a pittance to survive, to maybe move out of their car or something like that. And yet, you know, these small group of investors and board members control more money than they could spend if they lived thousands of years. I mean, that's insane. If somehow our life expectancy was prolonged through some kind of technology, they still wouldn't run out of money. They could spend $1,000 a day for the rest of their lives and still have plenty left over. And again, they didn't do anything to create this. They were rich ahead of time, many times because of inheritance, because of coming from wealthy families. And they put that money into Apple, and then it became worth more. And they just kind of sat around and hung out while the money accumulated more. And then what do you know? At the end of the process, it's worth even more. They didn't contribute to society, and they didn't benefit it. They weren't necessary towards the process. But who was necessary is the workers that actually build and produce these things that we use, and that have become such a huge part of our life and society.
Let's go on to another story. AT&T has suffered a terrible injustice. Again, wait a second. Do you feel bad? AT&T, another big corporation, they have suffered right now.
They have. I actually know an AT&T executive, and you know, this is money out of his pocket. We should talk about this.
Yeah. Boy, I really feel terrible for AT&T. Well, let's let the audience understand why we feel so bad for AT&T.
So poor AT&T accidentally, or claims to have accidentally, overpaid a number of pensioners, and now has decided that they accidentally overpaid their pensioners. The pensioners retired, spent the money, maybe, you know, downsized, bought a new house. Who knows what they did with it, went on vacation. And now they are engaging with collections agencies to go after the pensioners to try to get their money back. So they are harassing pensioners to get money back that they accidentally gave them. And I want us to understand, how much money did they accidentally give them? Well, they accidentally overpaid about $1 million, $1 million bucks. And just to give you some, you know, sense of that, the AT&T CEO last year made $28.7 million in his salary. So they are going after pensioners, retired people who are currently, you know, enjoying the kind of fruits of their labor and a well-deserved rest, to get back $1 million, which is a fraction of what the AT&T CEO
gross.
Makes.
I no longer feel sorry for them. Oh my God.
You should not. I mean, can you imagine if he was paid $27.7 million and then they just called it a wash?
And then, like, if you want to talk about being overpaid, just go to any CEO of any of these corporations. $27 million a year, that's overpaid. but they get to write the rules. Again, it's the owners, the owning class. They don't actually do work. They don't do work. Like if that AT&T CEO, you know, God forbid, slipped into a coma and was in the coma for the next year.
Right.
I don't think any of us who are reliant on AT&T services would notice. But, you know, if the working people who do the work went into a coma or fell asleep, didn't come to work, got sick, we'd all notice right away.
Absolutely. And that goes for Apple or any of these companies. If all the workers who produce the parts went home or just didn't come to work, the company would fall apart. It would grind to a halt. And you're right. The CEO, you know, it's not necessary. They are replaceable. Boards fire them all the time. They, you know, get into trouble and step down in disgrace with a golden parachute or whatever. They're totally unnecessary. They're just sort of kind of a ridiculous figurehead. In this case, AT&T decided that rather than take $1 million from the incredibly overpriced CEO, that they instead go after pensioners by harassing them through collection agencies to get them to pay back, oh, sometimes $20,000, sometimes the article reports someone getting harassed for $32,000. And this money's gone. It's gone. They spent
it. Like, so I'm looking, John, at the Wall Street Journal article. The headline is AT&T overpaid some pensioners. Now it wants the money back. The telecom giant has enlisted a collection agency.
Oh, boy.
A step other companies in similar situations have declined to take. And there's a picture of this gentleman. His name is James Mazzell. He lives here in Virginia, Round Hill, Virginia. He's sitting at a table. He's 70 years old. He's drinking a cup of coffee. And I want to read a couple of sentences from the Wall Street Journal article. When James Mazzell retired in 2001, he started drawing a pension from his 27-year career with AT&T and other phone companies. 15 years later, that would be 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, 15 years later, he got a letter saying his benefits were miscalculated and demanding that he repay $32,116.05. Mr. Mazzell, living in Round Hill, Virginia, replied that he couldn't repay. Within weeks, he heard from a collection agency. That money has been spent, said Mr. Mazzell, 70 years old, who had incurred medical bills in a battle with prostate cancer. I could not pay it back. But guess what? AT&T is going after Mr. Mazzell with a collection agency, trying to bring him down so that, again, CEO, $28 million a year, they lost $1 million because they overpaid James Mazzell, whatever, over a long number of years, probably just little and small increments.
Sure, so he didn't even notice it was...
He probably wouldn't have even noticed
he was being overpaid, right.
So he's fighting cancer, he's got big medical bills, he's 70 years old, pay us back. I don't know.
Yeah.
I hate the capitalist system,
John. This is exactly what's wrong with capitalism. I will say, in my own experience at the CIA often overpaid people by accident. Because depending on what city you're in, depending on what city you happen to be living in, they'll give you a differential. Maybe it's danger pay. Maybe it's really hot or it's really cold. You get an extra 5%. And so everybody's making a different amount of money. And they frequently overpay people. And if they realize that they've overpaid you, they'll send you a memo and say, hey, we've overpaid you by this much money. So you're going to notice a reduction in your paycheck. And then that's it. They don't ask for it back. It was their mistake. And frankly, that's exactly what AT&T should be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think of the pensioners. I mean, what were they supposed to do?
Exactly.
Double check AT&T's math?
Exactly.
Were they supposed to? They don't even have access to their financial records. They couldn't even double check their math to make sure that it's right. It's not like they have AT&T's balance sheet, you know, in their home. They worked hard. They earned a pension. Then they started getting paid out. And so they spent it on their living expenses. And it's not even like this guy was living luxuriously. The poor man was trying to survive cancer. You know, I'm sure he'd much rather have spent that money on something else. And this kind of shows the brutality, you know, of this system, that there can be a group of people that can come together and say, sit in a room with each other and talk and say, let's harass old retired people for money that we gave them by mistake. That $1 million won't really affect much. You know, our operating expenses dwarf that, you know, in a single year.
Yeah, that's a rounding error.
Yeah, that's a rounding error. This is worth it. Let's make these people's lives uncomfortable and miserable. Let's make them feel bad for some reason that they were overpaid. And that's good. This is a business decision. This makes sense. Let's you know, make these people's lives more miserable. There are humans in rooms that make these decisions. And that's the kind of insanity of this constant lust and thirst for profit, is that in the current organization of society, that makes sense. It makes sense to harass old people, to make them give back money, to make them pay you back because they had to spend some money on cancer treatment. That it's logical, that it makes sense, that it's not some kind of crime against humanity or some sort of, you know, morally disgusting thing. It is business sense, and many investors would, you know, applaud it and approve of it. That is the problem we're talking about here, because we're incentivized to abuse people in this way, to take advantage of people in this way, rather than being incentivized to treat, you know, human beings like human beings with dignity and respect.
An AT&T spokesman says the pension overpayments affect, quote, significantly less than 0.1% of its 517,000 participants, meaning people who are getting pensions, with, quote, a very small percentage referred to collections. So they're justifying going after these pensioners by saying it doesn't affect except a small handful. They also declined to say how the company identified the errors they made in how much in determining who got what in terms of pension payouts. Daniel Sankey is our guest, financial policy analyst. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday in this segment called a weekly, well, it's called False Prophets, and that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S.
Very clever.
Not biblical prophets, like the prophets. False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel, let's go on to the next story.
So the next story that I thought would be worth discussing was bringing up how companies make money off of charging prisoners to communicate with the outside world. So it was an article in Wired about how various corporations charge, basically gouge prisoners in prisons all over the U.S. to send emails or to make phone calls. All of us are used to, you know, our usual kind of monthly rate that we have to pay to AT&T or whatever to get access to the internet. We have, of course, unlimited emails, right? Once you have internet access, you know, you might not even have to pay for it if you're using like a coffee shop's internet access or something. You can send as many emails as you want, right? But what you find is that the prison population is this very super exploited group of people, even though they're not often not able to be workers. They are being exploited by these companies that are charging them fees to send emails, to call people on the phone, and it's way above what we would normally expect. So it's pretty unbelievable. It goes on to detail, it's not just about email. I believe the thing says it was charging about 35 to 47 cents an email, which really adds up. And especially when you're a prisoner, it's not like you have a steady job where you have this pay that you can spend on these things. And really, I think this is a really important story to discuss, because what people don't realize is how much money these telecom companies are making out of prisoners who are really forced to pay. It's not like they can choose a different service that's cheaper. It's not like there's other competitive services that they can try to, you know, get the best price. It's either pay this or you don't get to talk to the other human beings in your life, and you're forced to essentially, you know, just kind of be alone and rot in prison. This is another form of exploitation, and why companies like AT&T are worth the, you know, billions and billions of dollars, and probably someday trillions, that they're worth, because they can take advantage of populations like these, and that is exactly what they're doing.
You know, it really is predatory. I had this as my own personal experience when I was in prison for 23 months. I was fortunate because I had a lot of friends and relatives and supporters who would put money in my commissary account. You use the money that's in your commissary account to pay for your very, very limited emails and what little phone time you're allowed to have. Every prisoner in the federal system gets 300 minutes per month, unless you're a rat, in which case you get 400 minutes per month. But Daniel's exactly right. AT&T and other predatory telecommunications companies make a lot of money off of society's poorest people. If you are indigent and you're in prison, you just can't send an email. As Daniel points out, it doesn't really cost any money to send an email. It doesn't cost AT&T anything but maybe a fraction of a penny. But you're charged as much as a dollar to send an email. Well, if you're poor, a dollar is a lot of money. If you're poor, a dollar is three packs of ramen noodles that you can eat. Otherwise, there's no help for you.
Yeah, and let's not forget that people in prison, and we're talking about a lot of people in America, People are virtually, let's call it what it is. It's virtually enslaved.
It's slavery.
It's an enslaved population.
Yes.
The 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery for the enslaved African people who were enslaved at the end stage in the South, but early in the formation of this country in all states, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery and involuntary servitude except as punishment for a crime. So it's legal. In other words, the enslavement of these 2.3 million people. And then the corporations are able to, because people want to communicate with their loved ones, charge them enormous amounts of money just to be able to communicate. Also, Daniel, you're in California. You guys are having all of these raging wildfires. Who's fighting those fires? Also, prisoners for $1, $2 a day.
Yeah, it's incredibly brutal and exploitative. These prisoners, you know, are being used as slave labor to fight fires, which is incredibly dangerous and life-threatening. But they're being utilized by these, you know, private services that pay them peanuts, right? And that's the crazy thing. Like, you know, there's supposed to be this sort of protection of a minimum wage, but suddenly that all goes out the window when you're a prisoner. Like, you know, oh no, you don't have the right to, you know, even the most minimum of wages. And yeah, it's an unbelievable way that corporations use to drive down wages for other people, because now you're competing with slave labor, which is very hard to do because, of course, that's super exploited and you can't work for a dollar, you know, a day or whatever.
The privately owned companies are paying the firefighters like $10.50 an hour. Mm-hmm. They're working alongside inmates who are making $2 a day.
Right. And last year, inmates died fighting these fires.
Absolutely.
Yes. So it's both things. The prisoners are super exploited, enslaved, basically, but it also drives down the wages of employed firefighters. They're making $10.50 an hour. I mean, that's
to put your life on the line.
It's not even that. I mean, firefighters are trained to deal with these things, and they have experience. You know, they go through a lot of training and education so that they don't, you know, get killed or seriously injured fighting these things. I doubt there's any sort of such training for prisoners. I imagine it's minimal at best. You know, they're only paying them this tiny amount of money. They don't care if they live or die. If they do die, you know, they're going to kind of bury the story and try to keep it quiet so that, you know, there's no public outrage for them burning prisoners to death. And even then, you know, they're going to try to use the narrative that, well, they were in jail for a reason. You know, they did bad things. And therefore, if they die in a fire, well, you know, that's what you get for doing bad things. You should be a law-abiding citizen.
Bury the prisoner, bury the story. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined, as we are every Tuesday, by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. This segment is called False Profits: A Weekly Look at Wall Street and Corporate Capitalism. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.